All right, hi everyone. We know that we're the only ones standing between you and beer, so we'll try to get this done, wrap this up. All right, so today we're going to talk a little bit about building and running Cloud Native Cassandra. My name is Joey, and this is Vinay from Netflix. And just to give you like a little bit of an idea of who we are and why you should maybe, I don't know, like think that we're not crazy, we have a little bit of a history working with distributed systems, both Cassandra and other ones. We both work on the cloud data engineering team. My name is Joey, and this is...
Vinay, I'm part of the same team, cloud data engineering, focusing on Apache Cassandra and other data abstractions.
All right, so today we're going to go through kind of three phases of the talk. We're going to talk a little bit about what exactly does cloud native even mean. It's kind of a loaded term, I think. Then we're going to kind of go through a couple of different ways that Cassandra has rough edges being Cassandra native, or sorry, cloud native. And then we'll talk about how Netflix solves those problems internally, and then how we think we might be able to extend some of those solutions to the open source in ways that we think are like realistic to actually get merged. So let's start with what even is cloud native. I think that it basically means that we interoperate well with a large number of cloud providers. And for the purpose of this talk, I'm just going to focus on the big three. So Amazon, that's where Netflix runs, Google Cloud, and Microsoft Azure. And if we drill down into it, what we really mean when we say cloud native is essentially almost any hardware, software, or any kind of situation, any kind of operation or configuration we might have to run Cassandra on. So for example, one thing that you might be able to assume is that there's some kind of cloud control plane that's like launching and killing instances. And as part of those instances, they might have any configuration of RAM, CPU, different kinds of disks. They might be running Windows for some weird reason. And we as a community, to be cloud native, have to integrate well with these different situations. So what that means is throughout this talk, we're going to be talking about how do we create the right seams in the project so that we're able to integrate with those different clouds. But also a key idea is that when people are operating in the cloud, we think that they're trying to treat their data stores and their services as cattle, not pets. Are people familiar with that phrase? Essentially what that means is that we don't name them, right? We're not like, you know, oh, this is Cassandra server one. It's like, no, this is like IA34, right? We don't think of them as pets. We instead think of them as a group of machines that are going to get something done that we want. But I also think that being cloud native means that you lose the HDMI connection. One moment. Okay, yeah, being cloud native means that everything's failing all the time. Clouds provide some type of abstraction layer on top of data centers, but that doesn't mean that they've solved failures. So, for example, your isolation zones, which try to isolate failures to a zone, they're going to fail. Sometimes the networks between them are going to fail within a region. Sometimes regions won't be able to talk to each other at all. And sometimes, like we found out last week, durable storage turns out to not be so durable. So we have to keep in mind that clouds are also chaotic, and we have to try to engineer seams and systems into Cassandra that will make them more capable of dealing with this. So today we're going to tell you a story in four parts in the classic Netflix fashion. We're going to talk about how Cassandra starts from development, moves to packaging, how we start a cluster on a cloud, and then how we scale a cluster on the cloud. And we're going to kind of go through each one. And this is going to be kind of a conversation between me and Vinay. And we hope that afterwards we can start some conversations with some of you if you have similar experiences or ideas. All right, so let's start with develop.
All right. I think the interesting area for new contributors to come and start working on Apache Cassandra project, we try to categorize this problem into four different areas. One, documentation, code, build, and test. So our idea behind focusing on these areas is to be a cloud-native database and to be for any new contributor to just start plugging in things, start trying out things in their environment, and try to put their plugins and deploy it in their cloud environment. Right? So this is our first landing page for any new users when they are trying to learn about Apache Cassandra. They would like to know how database works. There's not a lot of information. They would like to know where they can download the latest photo Cassandra bits and try it out. There's not a lot there. This is the front facing of Apache Cassandra, and it's in a sad state.
Yeah, so at Netflix, we do a lot of projects that have cloud-native documentation, and when we get a lot of feedback that people like that we have documentation for running software on different clouds, mostly AWS, but different clouds as well. And we do it internally by using MakeDocs. So this is basically a Markdown-based system. It's similar to our Sphinx generator. But I think the key differentiator is that we think it's really important that the moment you commit docs, they should be published. Like, there should be no process to get docs up, because otherwise people are just not going to update them. So here's an example of how we integrate Markdown with GitHub Pages, where we just push to a branch, and then this just publishes. And this actually leads to situations at Netflix where it's easier for us to merge internal documentation about Cassandra by a lot than it is for us to contribute that to open source. So for example, in this case, you write some Markdown, you could even write it in a browser, then you create a pull request in a browser, and then the moment that pull request gets merged, the docs get automatically built and deployed within about 30 seconds. So this type of situation, we think, encourages people to write docs and create those integration points.
I think the proposal is very simple here. Let's move our SVN-based documentation site to a Git branch repo, where it's easy for any new contributors or existing developers to contribute to our documentation and start working on replacing a Spinix documentation with Markdown or a Pandoc or something which is modern and easy to work with. And having automatically, build and publish through with the help of, work that TLP folks put in with the dockerization and stuff, it's easy to just build the stuff and publish to the website from our, Apache Jenkins. So, and we are not alone doing this in Apache ecosystem, right? So I took an example of Apache Beam, where they have a similar concept. They have a documentation branch on the GitHub, easy to contribute and pretty quick to deploy.
Cool. So when developers are first interacting with the project, they see the docs, but then the next thing they're like, okay, well, I want to add my little integration. Like, maybe I need to add a seed provider, I need to add something little to get running. And so they check out the code, and they immediately are granted or are greeted with a, typically, to be frank, a totally non-standard Java project. Like, that is using build tools from 5-6 years ago and doesn't natively interact with IntelliJ until you actually tell it to. A quick anecdote. We had a developer who has patched Cassandra internally numerous times and deployed like fairly significant ones that didn't realize that if you ran generate idea files, all of a sudden Cassandra would work with IntelliJ. Like he had been making serious patches that actually touched production in significant ways without realizing this. And that's because like at Netflix, it just works. Like you download a Java project and it's just it's in the format. The source and tests are laid out in a standard Java way. They're using like a build Gradle. They have dependency locks. And we think that that's really kind of the direction that we're going to have to go.
Yeah, so. I think the proposal here is, why not we use modern build systems which are designed to solve this problem. If you look at our Ant build file, we are trying to do a lot of things in one single file. So we are trying to do several projects building like integration tests and, JVM D-test and, all the tools are just in one massive file, but if you look at Gradle build system, which is designed with much more modular fashion to try different things for a modularity and extensibility options, it's pretty easy to build several things independently and roll out quickly. But the question is, can we do that for Cassandra? I mean, we tried that internally at Netflix, so importing existing build.xml file and trying out with the build.gradle, and also, building the Debians and RPMs according to the target environment is pretty easy with, Gradle build system.
Yeah, so I think the proposal here is pretty straightforward. We can incrementally move from the status quo to kind of a modular future, first by just importing the build.xml. So for example, in Netflix, we already have modularized Gradle builds on top of our internal Cassandra just by importing build.xml. It's a really easy transition. It works very seamlessly. And then we can gradually modernize. Like new features can stop going in build.xml. They can go in modules that then get built independently. And then one of the really great things about this also is that we can move to like industry standard dependency locking instead of checking in jars into the code, which I mean, is a good way to get a dependency lock, actually. It just is very expensive. And we're not really alone in this, right? Like a lot of Apache projects have migrated seriously complicated builds to Gradle. Both the Beam project and Kafka, just quick browse, use Gradle. And like if you look at, for example, the Apache Beam projects build.gradle, like the modules that they have, if that was in one build.xml, like the way that we do it, it would be probably 40,000 lines of build code. Like it's crazy. Like go check out the number of modules that they build. But they're able to kind of isolate that complexity by using that modular build system. All right, this is test.
So, yeah, in terms of testing, if you look at our Jenkins build system, you know, it takes hours to build, and very few people in the community knows even how to kick off those builds. And we have done pretty good amount of work in the community by migrating to CircleCI, as anyone can run these CircleCI builds and literally take a few minutes to run them.
Yeah, so I think our proposal here is also pretty straightforward. We think that the CircleCI direction is great. It makes it really easy for people who want to test out their change. Like maybe they need to make a minor change, they can test it out really easily. But we also, this might be a little more controversial, we think every pull request should have unit tests run. The number of regressions that we would fix just by having that happen on every pull request. Unit tests can be run on the free tier. So we think that this hopefully isn't too controversial. It's basically keep doing the stuff that we're already doing. All right, so now we've talked about development, and the reason we want to start with that is because we do think that the developers interacting with the project is the first step of cloud nativity. It's like they look at the project and they say, like, is this something that we think we can mold to our cloud and to our deployment? But the next question they have is, okay, well, how do I actually deploy it?
So, yeah. So in terms of distribution, you know, we looked at source, and the next thing is about integrating with their existing cloud ecosystems or existing their package managers, like, you know, apt and yum and brew. And third part of it comes from containers so that they can easily deploy in different environments and test it with their integration test suites. Well, so we already tackled it in several steps. When it comes to packages, you know, we already have a pretty good Debian and RPM integration, but, you know, any other custom packages is kind of difficult. But if you look at the way we are distributing our packages, is the Debian package starts automatically when you install it. So if you're trying to start a 100-node Cassandra cluster in a cloud environment, you're technically spinning 100 different Cassandra clusters. I mean, that's not good, and that's not cloud native, and somebody has to build in that orchestrator on top of Debian's, or they just don't use the packages that we ship.
Yeah, and yes is as easy as putting like a rc.d or whatever, but people still have to know to do that. And we think that one part of being cloud native is things working out of the box in the way that people would expect them to. And one area that we're not doing as hot on is containers. So I always think this is fun, because we get a lot of support questions of, like, you know, how should I use Docker or Cassandra and Docker? And then we point them to this. And then people immediately point out, like, wait a minute, the official Docker image is maintained by the Docker community. It's not maintained by, like, Cassandra doesn't have an official Docker image. And then they go, and we go, yeah. And they go, well, can we use it? And I go, you don't want to use that image. You don't want to use that image because it is really slow to start up. Like, it takes, like, 15 or 20 seconds for it to even boot up, which if you're spinning up that cluster or spinning up that container for, like, every test and you're running 1,000 tests, you're going to be waiting forever.
Yeah, so the way we solve it at Netflix is pretty easy, right? So we remove the unnecessary step from the default Docker image to start the Cassandra cluster. For example, we disable the vNodes. We ensure that there are not more than one node running for your integration test. So just skip the gossip settling. And with that, we were able to get it under 5 second startup time because this Docker it runs on every test class that they are having, and it just makes it easy for them to integrate with the Docker, with the Cassandra and with the Docker, instead of using the live clusters to run their integration tests. And it also reduces the memory footprint, so we can control all that stuff for the faster integration development.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of brings to our proposal here. So with source, we do earlier suggestions with packages, I think we have very little to do there. We just need to make it so that Cassandra packages don't auto-start the service. But on containers, like I think it'd be really great if we could work as a community. I know that a number of people run Kubernetes operators that have like production-ready images. We don't run Cassandra as containers in production, so we can't really make any recommendations there. But we think that as a community, we could come together to publish official testing and containers that are ready to run out of the box on Kubernetes or Swarm deployments. Docker Swarm deployments. Speaking of running on the cloud, now we'd like to kind of transition out of kind of the code base and transition into actually running Cassandra natively in a cloud. And that starts with launch. And we actually think that the previous talk actually covered a little bit of this. So
yeah. I think that was a good segue from Jay on about how we are managing the seats, how we are managing the tokens, and also how we are managing the processes within the Cassandra ecosystem. So you want to talk?
No. Yeah. Okay. That was faster. So in Netflix, we solve these problems basically with control planes. So the seeds are determined from AWS cloud control planes. Tokens are determined by our cluster control plane, similar to the idea of like delegating token assignment to somebody else. And then the process is like just use systemd. You know, we feel like that's pretty obvious. But just to dive into this a little bit, how does the declarative control plane actually work? Well, when we launch 100 nodes, when we launch a 100-node Cassandra cluster, we don't let Cassandra allocate tokens because Cassandra will allocate tokens poorly. So instead, they start off in our control plane and they say, like, do I already have a token? And if they don't already have a token, then they acquire one from the control plane, which is already pre-allocated. Just like Jay said, the control plane already knows how many nodes are going to be in this cluster and already knows where their token position should be. Then it has to ask, though, is this a new cluster? And it has to do this because there's this really hilarious thing that happened in, I think, Cassandra 3, maybe it was 2.2. You actually have to return different seeds depending on whether or not you're kind of like bootstrapping for the first time. So if you're bootstrapping for the first time, then you return yourself as a seed, which allows you to get past the could not gossip with any other peers. But otherwise, you return the first node in the availability zone. And then this also helps with gossip convergence because every node is essentially picking the same node as determined by Amazon. So Amazon gives you a consistent view. In fact, all cloud providers that I'm aware of have an API that you can ask, give me the list of nodes in this availability zone, or in this auto-scaling group, in the case of Amazon, and then it will give you a consistent view of the cluster. So we don't have to solve this hard problem. Amazon's already solved it. And then we just launch Cassandra with those seed providers. But it's not enough just to get the seeds. We also have to provide tokens. And to do that, again, we use the same type of pole-based control plane. So the first step is whether or not the cluster is an EBS-backed one, because if it is EBS-backed, token acquisition is super easy. You just find a volume that has a token on it, and then you can attach it, like EC2 and most cloud, in fact, all clouds that I'm aware of, provide a way to query volumes by tags. So you can tag a volume with like a token or a set of tokens that volume has, and then you can just ask for it from the control plane. So it kind of bypasses solving that hard problem, once again, by leveraging that integration point that the cloud provider already gives you. But maybe you're not using EBS, so you have to actually determine whether or not you're replacing another node. Well, if you aren't replacing another node, then that's great. You just start up Cassandra. But if you are replacing another node, then you start going through, at least at Netflix, you start going through this kind of, flow state here, where you find a buddy in the cluster using it's essentially a zookeeper. It's console, if people are familiar with console. But you find a buddy, you take all that buddy's data from S3 because you're constantly backing up. Then you do a little bit of a fix up where you get anything that you missed since the backup, and then you verify that data using a hash function. So just like I think it was Scylla was talking about repair, like we found that we can verify terabyte data sets in just a few minutes using XXHash, and by bypassing Cassandra streaming and just going straight from S3 or using EBS, we can actually take terabyte amounts of state and transfer them between nodes extremely quickly. And this is partially because, I mean, honestly, this is an easier problem. Like, when you're coming from S3, you can use full instance bandwidth. Like, you're not competing with live queries. You're not competing. And this is something that is kind of unique to clouds, I think, because you can use these blob storage APIs in the case of Amazon S3, in the case of GCS, Google blob storage. And then the fix-up can be done with direct file copy. And I mean, Cassandra 4 is launching, I think, with a really amazing feature where we can actually do direct file copy in Cassandra. That's really cool. We've been using it for a while. It works great. direct file copy is way faster than trying to actually push data through the heap, as we've learned with the 4.0 patches. And then I guess maybe the other lesson learned here is that XXHash can actually validate all the data. Like, we don't even have to bother with, like, Merkle trees. We can just hash all the data with XXHash. Like, it goes at essentially your full disk bandwidth. So on an i3 4x large, you have 4 gigabytes per second, and an XXHash will use all of that. So we don't really think it's a problem. And just to kind of motivate that further, this is important to us because it entirely calculates how fast we can move nodes around when we're launching them and when we're scaling them. So here's some quick math. If we've got a 288 node cluster that has 500 gigs of data per node, if we're going to use streaming, we have to limit ourselves to only 200 megabits per second. So if we limit ourselves to 200 megabits per second, which is a little bit optimistic if you've actually, like, traced Cassandra streaming, it'll take you 6 hours to do one node. And then if you do 288 of those, it'll take you 2.3 months to migrate the data from one set of nodes to another. I don't know about you, Vinay, but I think that is an absolutely absurd amount of time to wait for what is essentially 100 terabytes. And indeed, if you bypass streaming and go straight from S3, go straight from the source of truth, then you can download, you can spin up all of those nodes in the cloud, and then you can have them all download from S3 simultaneously at full network bandwidth. So on an i3-2, you get 2 gigabits per second. On i3-4, you get 4 gigabits per second. On i3-8, you get 10 gigabits per second. You're not, like, no matter what the instance size is, you get proportional network bandwidth, which means that you can recover, in this case, a 100 terabyte data set in about half an hour plus then 10 minutes for the fix-up times 288. So just migrating from using streaming to using massively parallel S3 download with a fix-up, you can bring it down from 2.3 months to 2.02 days, which is, like, already much better.
Yes.
But still too slow. That's not good enough, right? We can't be waiting for 2 days for a cluster to scale. So instead, what we can do is we can take advantage of Cassandra's network topology strategy and bring whole zones down. So we can do that fix-up period in a whole zone in parallel. Now, obviously, this requires us to, like, require that people only use network topology strategy and things like that, which you should be doing. But if you do this, then you can take down whole zones, then your time gets reduced down to a mere 1.5 hours. Now, 1.5 hours is something that I can do in a workday, so that actually makes me kind of happy, because this means that I can upgrade 100 terabytes. I can transfer 100 terabytes of state in less than 2 hours. I mean, like, I've had coffee breaks that are longer than that, so that's I think that's pretty good, and that's where we are right now, all from leveraging unique capabilities of cloud environments. For process control, we just use systemd. I think everybody just creates this file on their own. Like, I've seen there's a ticket that has this file, more or less. There's, like, advice, and, like, if you Google Cassandra systemd, there's a systemd file which looks just like this. Like, everybody is already just shipping this. Like, I feel like we can just ship it. But it does things like handle automatic process restarts, handles console logs. It's really great. I think the only kind of secret sauce, if you will, that Netflix does is we actually wrap the Cassandra bin script with kind of two interesting pieces of functionality. That so the first one is we use this tool called Happy Cache to actually reload OS page caches. So when we transfer state from one node to another, we've lost the OS page cache. So that means that, you know, reads against that data set are going to be much slower than they would if we had a hot page cache. So you can use this tool called Happy Cache, which is extremely performant on Linux. It basically just saves some metadata about what pages were cached, and then you can, on the receiving server, you can transfer that metadata, and then the receiving server can, at full disk bandwidth, touch all of those pages into page cache. So this happy cache load adds, like, maybe a minute or 2 minutes to fresh hardware's startup times, but it means that we can be very nimble with our data movements and not worry about performance impacts. As far as our customers know, nothing's changed. And the other thing that's kind of nice here is that we use flocked PID files to guarantee that only a single process is running. No more, like, pgrepping JPS and, like, being like, is there something else that looks something like Cassandra? It's like, no, we'll just flock the PID file. And then this actually is an extremely strong guarantee. Since we rolled this out, we've had zero problems with duplicate Cassandra processes running. So those are really the only thing that we do that's kind of special, I guess. And this leads us to our proposal.
Yeah, I think the proposal is very simple, Joey. So we talked about all the good things that we are doing in Netflix. How about we start providing that as part of, plugins as part of Sidecar for major cloud providers out there, ability to plug plug all the, you know, the token providers and AWS control plane and, you know, Azure control plane related code as part of plugins for the seeds. And for token management, if you look at the ticket 13701 to reduce the number of default, you know, vNodes, that adds a token provider interface where, with the ability to anyone can plug in, you know, token provider implementation. So, for example, in Instagram's case, they can plug in their own implementation. In our case, we can plug in the implementation that we use in Priyam. And for we can also provide default plugins for, you know, Azure and Google Cloud and stuff like that. And maybe to fix the process, just add what we got in the systemd, and you know, I'm sure HappyCache is already open source, so we can just add that as part of our systemd unit and take it from there. So I think so far we talked about you know, development, you know, frictions and distributions, and also we talked in length about launch. And let's see what is stopping from, you know, being a cloud native to run it at a scale. So we try to categorize in, this in four different areas. One is a metrics, insights into the performance of Cassandra, and monitoring to see what is happening with Cassandra cluster, and in terms of integrity for backups and restores, and you know, repair operations out of the box from Cassandra, and also easily be able to easily in a unified way across different cloud providers to easily configure, start, and stop Cassandra. So getting into the problems with the metrics we have, even though we call our metrics are pluggable with the help of Drop Wizard, they're not really fully pluggable. If you look at the histogram implementation for our metrics, you know, every major you know, metrics you know, provided has their own representation of histogram. You know, let's just back it by interface and get these you know, different histogram implementation out there. For example, if you look at the histograms from Prometheus, histograms from Spectator and Stats, they all have a different implementation. Even though we say with the JMX we are interoperable with different language ecosystems, but we have added a lot of implementation into JMX with the, in terms of notifications and stuff like that. You know, that makes it really hard for any non-Java shop to just start, you know, getting these insights from Cassandra pretty hard. You know, and exporting these metrics is also not a, you know, performance solution that we have.
So Netflix solves this. Netflix solves the first part of this metrics with an agent. So we have the open source spectator agent, which we attach to Cassandra. I think the only thing that's really kind of interesting here is while adding this agent, we did add a nice seam that I think might be worth thinking about, which is that in our Cassandra env, version of Cassandra, we actually create this agents folder. So there's this agents folder in Cassandra Home, and then any agents which are in that folder automatically get added to a Cassandra. So it becomes very easy to just plug in new metrics agents, like, oh, you've got the Prometheus exporter, no problem, just symlink that in. Oh, you've got the spectator agent, no problem, just symlink that in. And then you can also, it also supports things like, this is all the bash that's required to make it work, right? It's not complicated, it's not rocket science, but it does create a nice seam that makes it easy for people to plug in their own metrics exporter or metrics system. So yeah, I guess that kind of leads us to the proposal.
Yeah, I think proposal we already talked about in terms of making the histograms pluggable, and you know, the script that we just showed makes any having any different types of agent easily pluggable. And let's just try to expose HTTP metrics from Cassandra itself so that we can build, you know, all different tooling on top of it. And, you know,
Okay, so the next problem we want to talk about is monitoring. So when you're scaling Cassandra up, there's no real way to know a cluster view. Like, yes, you can run NodeTool status, but that doesn't actually tell you the state of the cluster, because as we saw yesterday in the previous talk, gossip takes a while to converge. Nodes might not have an equal view of the cluster. So when people start asking, like, they've deployed it out to the cloud and they're asking, is the ring healthy? There's no real way for them to know that unless they run NodeTool status on every node and then, like, I don't know, like, look at their terminal in a way that I don't know how to do. It's hard to do, and it's also hard to answer simple questions like where is this piece of data, and they have to go like dig up you know, NodeTool documentation and be like, okay, well, does get endpoints take a keyspace data table? Does it take, like, there's definitely user interface friction here, and at Netflix.
Yeah. At Netflix, we solved this problem with all the tooling that we built in terms of monitoring the health check. So so we talked in detail in our previous talk about monitoring Cassandra with the help of Sidecar. So we send all the heartbeat metrics from each and every instance to a health check database, which is a kind of intent store. And we have a stream processing similar to Flink running on top of these heartbeats and build a state, the cluster view of health across your massive cluster. So this can easily help us to build these clean little dashboards to figure out where is the gossip issue, which node has issue talking to which other node. And also it just scales with the as your Cassandra databases are scaling, right? So this is also another way we monitor our Cassandra health and our Cassandra insights. This is our internal tooling where we have one place where you can look at the health, you can look at all different metrics and latencies and stuff like that. But we're not doing this alone. So there are many databases out there that are being shipped out of the box with all these capabilities. If you look at the CockroachDB, out of box it ships all different details in terms of cluster health, data size, metrics, query level metrics, and all the statements and log execution, stuff like that. And if you look at Elasticsearch, Elasticsearch solved this problem differently. So Elasticsearch exposes all of this as a REST API, on a REST API, and they have a plugin shipped with them, which can build on top of that REST API. Even if you see any Elasticsearch operator, even though these plugins are optional, everyone turns on by default because they are so easy for you to. They make your life so easy to operate Elasticsearch. So they are pretty much default on in majority of the deployments. So once we start shipping our metrics and insights through HTTP interface, we can open up opportunities to build these kind of plugins and easy to operate in a cloud native environment.
Yeah, so we think that the proposal here is pretty straightforward. We'll just ship an out-of-the-box health and status endpoint. We're already actually made a lot of progress. Chris, Dinesh, and Vinay have been working on the Sidecar project, which I believe already has some startings of health and status endpoints, HTTP endpoints. But just honestly, even if we just had JSON metrics and status, we don't even have to build a dashboard. If we just build a JSON endpoint, I bet you that there are no developers out there who will spit out UIs in 2 weeks. Elasticsearch did this. It worked great for them. I think it can work for us. And the Sidecar may be the right place for this. We think it is. And the talk tomorrow about the Sidecar, I think if you're interested in maybe contributing some of this, the Sidecar tomorrow is a great place to talk to Dinesh and myself about. We'd love to get more integrations into the Sidecar that help bring these kinds of dashboards to our customers out of the box. All right.
So in terms of integrity and administrate areas, so in a cloud-native environment, nodes and clusters constantly fail. Their network fails, their hard disk fail. The nodes themselves just disappear from the from your ecosystem. It is critical for any of these cloud-native databases to ship with out-of-box backup, restore, and repair functionality so that it's easy to just get it up and running. And if you look at Cassandra, there's no easy there's no standard or easy way to operate these things. Yeah, and along with there's no easy way to configure, restart Cassandra clusters.
So Netflix works around this by adding some additional functionality in Sidecar. Who's familiar with the Priam project? Decent number. Okay. Well, just really quickly, Priam is Netflix's cloud native. Sidecar, which helps us integrate with the AWS cloud. And the way it solves some of these problems is by implementing those control planes that we talked about earlier. So for example, in the case of backup, we offer a point-in-time, what we call incremental snapshot. So just to differentiate that from incremental backups, we're actually offering a fully consistent snapshot backup at every hour, or in optionally every 30 minutes. And the way that we do this is by diffing the state and keeping track of what we've already uploaded and then taking advantage of Cassandra's LSM nature. But Priam also supports plugins for backing up to different clouds. Currently, I believe AWS and Google are supported. It's not that hard to put this functionality behind an interface. We we do it on Priam. We think we can do it elsewhere. It's also how we do repair. So Priam implements a distributed control plane for checking in with a repair database. Basically, every node emits the state, every node follows the repair state machine, which we've diagrammed out in the 14.346 ticket. It's a pretty complicated state machine, but the end result is that it means that no matter how big your cluster is, no matter how many clusters you have, repair scheduling comes out of the box and just works. Like at Netflix, people launch a cluster and it automatically starts repairing. There's no, like, you don't have to tell it to start repairing. It just comes out of the box with repair. It comes out of the box with subrange repair. It comes out of the box with checkpointing. It makes it a lot easier on us operating in the cloud. But it doesn't end with just repair. We also use declarative control planes for administering. So, for example, when we want to restart the cluster, we don't, you know, SSH in a for loop running restart. We write a desire into the same kind of desire store saying, hey, we'd like this cluster to be over here. And then those agents that are running on every host, it's actually not Priam. It's a different agent, but it could be Priam. All that agent does is watch this desire store and say, hey, the world is different from what is desired, and I will try to take actions to move it towards that. So, for example, in this case, it might transition into that like data transfer state machine that we talked about earlier. So an example of a really simple state machine is the restart state machine. It's as simple as this. Like, every node just says, like, hey, is the ring healthy? Can I take myself out? And if it is, then it locks a replica set. It basically says, okay, my neighbors should not be able to restart because I'm restarting. Then it checks ring health again to make sure that it didn't concurrently race into state two. If everything is good at that point, then it fails its health check. So this is also like a really key piece of functionality is when we're ready to take down a Cassandra node, we actually fail a health check for a minute so that clients drain off, because otherwise we found that the clients actually continue talking to Cassandra for a while after it's actually shut down. Basically, drain is not sufficient. So we fail health checks for a minute ahead of time, then we drain, and then we shut down. But this is like an example of a really simple state machine that we could like implement in the sidecar maybe. And that's the proposal.
Yeah, I think the proposal is simple here. So we talked about all the great functionality that we added in Priam. And, you know, we just need to make it pluggable with any different cloud provider and start working towards Apache Cassandra project, because we can't expect every community, you know, member of Apache Cassandra to start implementing all the functionality that we implemented for repair, backup, and, you know, state machines like restart and configure. So how about to avoid the contention, make it pluggable and provide a default implementation for major cloud providers. And let's just continue investing in Apache Cassandra project, which helps us solve the problem of backup, repairs, and restart in a way we just talked about. I think, you know, we would like to close this conversation with the thought process on what it takes for the Apache Cassandra community and Apache Cassandra database to be fully cloud native in terms of development, in terms of package and distribution, and in terms of how we start databases and how we scale databases. I think, you know, as a Cassandra community, our users need better solutions, and we as a Cassandra community need community's help in contributing to these projects. And I think if you look at this problem on a big holistic way, it might be too big, but if you go with the targeted investment in each one of these areas, I think it's a very easy problem to solve, and we are almost there.
Yeah, so now would anybody like to discuss any of the things that we just talked about? A couple of people. Okay, John.
Did you look at, I'm assuming you're not super tied to the Markdown?
No.
Did you look at asking Dr. Rolfe to actually tie to really nicely?
There you go.
Awesome.
It was pretty easy. I mean, honestly, we're not stuck to anything, any one particular technology. We just think that it needs to be easier. We know the status quo is hard. We know that there are at least a dozen easier ones. Honestly, anyone. we just need someone to do the work. I think there was a question in the back. So help.
So the question is, a lot of times we mentioned sidecar, are we creating Jiras for all these actions? So we proposed CI Cassandra implement process one. As part of that, we are targeting 4 to 5 different areas. majority of the functionality is covered as part of CIP1, but the idea is, instead of throwing everything out there, in an iterative fashion, just ship CIP1 and start working on CIP, next CIP to add these features. And that's why we are looking for community help, for people to just join us.
I mean, we just haven't gotten around to it. You're also, we spent a lot of time writing up CIP1. At some point they have to be translated into JIRAs. We've been doing it as we're actually doing them. Some of them do have JIRAs. Yeah. I think it's fair to say that there are JIRAs for anything that we're actively, actually working on. There's a couple of things in CIP1 and that we just talked about, which I don't think anybody's actively working on, so we haven't got those yet. But we can do that. Yeah, Jordan. So if the question is, why don't we use a generic kind of cloud orchestrator like Terraform or Ansible, I think the answer is that those types of abstractions tend to make it hard to implement the, we actually think that these control planes and these state machines are somewhat complex, and it's actually really hard. I've tried to use Terraform to launch Elasticsearch clusters. I've used Terraform to try to launch Cassandra clusters. It's hard. For example, in Terraform, how do you encode the idea that one node needs to start up, allocate tokens, and then another one needs to start up and allocate tokens? Encoding those state machines, which are often somewhat arbitrary and coupled to the code, is actually pretty hard. We think that the more successful technique, instead of trying to find a cloud orchestrator that just works, is build plugins for different major cloud providers that implement a Java interface. Sure. I have had a lot of success, for example, having Terraform create an ASG which launches an AMI, and then that AMI contains Priam or other orchestrators that actually boot up the cluster. Terraform is a pretty good, I want 100 machines, press enter. It's also a pretty good way to say, I want 100 machines, press enter, and it accidentally deletes four of your data centers because you didn't notice the plus minus. So Priam's already open source. The only component there that's not open sourced in Priam is the repair service, which is open sourced as part of a Cassandra ticket, which is on hold until the feature freeze kind of lifts. All the control planes we talked about, with the exception of the data transfer one. Yeah, so EBS, CD cache replacement is not open source.
Yeah, I think all these, it's an easy way for us to open source in Priam and then work towards Apache Cassandra Sidecar. I think we stopped putting all of these efforts in a Priam open source and start putting that efforts in Apache Cassandra Sidecar. So easy way for us to move forward.
So we've kind of refocused. We're trying to contribute things. Now that there is an official sidecar to contribute to, we're trying to shift contributions there. But there are pieces in Priam. There are pieces in open source tickets. And now we just are trying. Now that we have a place to put them as a community, we can start kind of more quickly iterating on them. Yeah. I think Jordan had a question. Yes. You have to do ant and real clean, git clean, dash ffdx, I don't know if anything's changed in time. I think that as the project has grown, as we're trying to bring on more companies contributing, like essentially as the contributor base and as we shift into a world where developers who you've never heard of are going to come in and say, like, I want to build this project to like try to make this little patch so that I can run it in my infrastructure. I think we have to reevaluate these choices.
Idea is to reduce the friction, the barrier for any new contributors to just start working on this project and treat it as like any other open source project in the cloud native ecosystem. Right?
So. So it's hard for an established person who works on the project to say, like, as a relatively recently new, like, I'm relatively new to the project. Like, I can tell you that it was weird. Like,
honestly, I think the primary thing we have now is that, like, usually people just open a tier and, like, suggest doing this, but
yeah.
Do this, and
they're
like, yeah,
yeah, but, like, there are people like you to be in there.
So maybe to make it a little bit less contentious.
Take the argument to the boss.
Maybe to make it less contentious. One of the nice things about the way that we've integrated with Gradle is that if you want to keep writing build.xml, like, go ahead. But I know that, like, for example, as we're adding new modules, we can, like, if we have a Gradle that then imports the ant build, people who want to use, like, a modular build system can use a modular build system, and then we can incrementally, like I think that the community will shift over time. I don't think it's plausible to transition a 2,200 line build.gradle in, like, one commit. Like, it's hopeless. I think that things will move over time to, like, let's put it this way. Yeah, the Java community has already moved. The Java community moved. So as we get new developers and people who are used to that build system.
I think we haven't focused detailed enough on the friction for new contributors. Right? So, I mean, we're talking about transition problems, but I think the friction for new contributors and community is something.
I mean, honestly, even if you could just check out the code and, like, it just worked out of the box in Eclipse and IntelliJ without having to run a build step, that would also remove a large amount of the friction.
Works great in Emacs.
It does work great in Emacs. You can't trace any code, but other than that, it works. Maybe we should table the build discussion because we knew that was going to be a little bit contentious. Any other areas? Yeah.
And so regarding the data migration with S3,
yeah.
What kind of cluster operations do you do with it? Like
a bootstrap node. Yeah. So the question is, with the S3 and the data migration, what kind of operations we do it? So the way we migrate from one hardware to another hardware is completely from S3. And when we are scaling up the clusters, vertically scaling up the cluster, we use S3. And when there is AWS automatically terminates instances, we try to use the backup data too. Any other that you?
Yeah, we haven't currently replaced like the actual streaming implementation with just stream from S3. There's some, like, internal tickets on it, but it's not developed enough for us to propose it in any, like, so one thing that we try to limit ourselves to this in this presentation is we think that these proposals are, like, relatively straightforward. Like, they're small steps. If we were to propose, like, rip out streaming and replace it with, like, streaming from a remote file system, I think that would be a So you certainly could. So logically speaking, you could, especially with like things like leveled compaction strategy, which actually creates sorted runs. So let's say that you know that you need to take a certain range from node one. So you need range one. So you can just look in that node's in node one's backup for SS tables which match that range, and then you can pull them. You'll basically overstream by a factor of your leveled. So it's like if you have 160 megs, you'll pull like an extra 150 megs. I don't care because you can pull from S3 at 10 gigabits per second. So. Yeah. So I mean, I think calling that complicated and calling what we do in streaming simple is like a very interesting, like the current streaming implementation is exceedingly complicated. I actually think iterating a list of files and saying does this file lie in the range that I now own is like relatively simpler. Now compared to, I mean, I don't know, maybe Scylla's streaming implementation is a lot simpler, and maybe compared to that one, it's complicated. But I think it's relatively simple to what we have right now. Okay. Yeah, well, let's talk offline about it. It's interesting. I also think that it's something that we don't really have a concrete answer to right now, so that's why we're not really talking too much about it. All right, we're running low on time, so if you guys have any more questions, we'd be happy to talk at the back. Thanks.
Thank you.